The spirits shall walk, demanding atonement for the crimes of the past. We talk with Guy Madden about Keyhole on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast.
In the name of Jesus, Sparrows, Ulysses have us shoot our way into a building that's completely surrounded.
That's why he's the boss, Big Ed, and you're not.
This kind of weather stirs me up. Man's weather.
Don't you mention my son.
Look what you've done! Look what you've done! You've always been a terrible man.
Never trust your eyes, Ulysses. Never trust your eyes. Just one more night.
Why did Ulysses have you brought here?
Some girl may have drawn tonight. I was told that I had to examine her.
Danny!
That I had no choice in the matter.
Danny!
She's waterlogged. There's nothing can be done. Come on. For God's sake, she's cold as ice.
Remember, Ulysses. Remember.
I've wasted so much time already. You gotta find my wife.
Your wife, Ulysses, is with me at the very top of the house, where you need to be.
I'm coming, Isa. So many locked doors. And they all have to be opened.
Hey, welcome to MMP. I'm Dan Persons. In Keyhole, Jason Patrick plays Ulysses Pick, a gangster who invades his own home in order to resurrect and eliminate the spirits dwelling there, including his wife, played by Isabella Rossellini. And since this is a film by the supreme transformer of antique-style Guy Madden, co-written by his frequent collaborator George Toles, the photography will be black and white, the atmosphere will be noirish, and the tone will be that typical Madden mix of romance, regret, and anxiety. In the Madden tradition, it's a mystery film where the mystery is the desperate nature of the human soul. Oh, it's good. And Udo Kier is in there, too. Hey, Udo, how you doing? In any case, I do love talking with Madden. This is the first time I've been able to feature him on a podcast, and I'm delighted because text doesn't really transmit the experience. So, give a listen to the conversation and enjoy. So, a gangster ghost story, or a ghostly gangster story. Which
yeah, that's one of the classic, you know, mashups of the new century, you know, cowboys and aliens sort of thing. I was always told my movies are impossible to classify. I always said, why, thank you. And then people said, like, especially distributors, went, no, that's not a good thing. You know, make a genre picture. Make something science fiction or horror or something. About 10 years ago, I made a ballet version of Dracula. And it was just meant for a one-off broadcast, but it did really well and ended up, you know, winning an Emmy and getting a theatrical release. And I realized it's probably just because it was a genre film, or two genres, dance and vampires. But I thought, they're probably right. So I thought it was time to make make a genre film. In this case, yet another mashup. I like the ghost meets gangsters. I think I dreamt that there were a whole bunch more than there really are. Maybe the closest thing is, like, Spooks Run Wild, things with the Bowery Boys and Bela Lugosi and stuff. Not exactly gangsters, but it seemed like a nice combination. And, now, of course, I find myself poised to hit the commercial big time.
Well, you got Jason Patrick in there, for Christ's sake. So.
He's great. Yeah, he's perhaps the American actor, you know, once a young Turk, still a solid performer, but most notorious for making all the wrong commercial decisions, mm-hmm. For which I love him, you know. And And to hear him speak on the subject is pretty inspiring, so makes me feel like all those wrong footsteps I took look like an Arthur Murray tango step in retrospect now.
You know, in my other hat, I do stuff for CineFantastic,
yeah.
which is a genre magazine. We've
yeah.
always covered your films.
Mm-hmm.
But it raises a question. I mean, we do science fiction, fantasy, horror. Are you comfortable being associated in that niche?
I grew up as a big horror movie buff. You know, could hardly wait for Famous Monsters of Filmland to come to the corner drugstore and stuff like that. And I was, because there were only so many monster movies for them to cover, every now and then they'd cover some, like a movie that only had one scene that could be qualified as horror or something like that. And that was fine for me. I think I make movies where, like, for one scene or for two scenes, maybe I might, spill over like pancake batter into some genre for a while and then come back into my sui generis thing. But, I'm just happy to be noticed,
I wanted to ask you about the tone of this film, because it struck me, I haven't seen your complete library. I've seen enough of them. It struck me that there's a certain restlessness to the tone of this film. I think
yeah.
it shows up most clearly at the beginning with the montage that you use there. But I get the feeling overall. Is that something you were aiming for?
I'll try to put my finger on it. There's a restlessness in me. I'm not sure if it's what you mean, but there's something always unsettled with me, and the accounts I keep with my past, and I'm always trying to get things right, even though I didn't get them right the first time. And so I'm often still in communion with people long gone, with places removed from me and things, just to sort of either say goodbye to them or to apologize to them or to just feel how important these things and people and places were to me the first time around. Just didn't quite get it right, so to feel it right this time. And so a lot of my movies are sort of backward glancing attempts at reopening stale dated cases and just settling scores with them. But to be honest, I have to, I guess I keep telling myself, I don't want to be considered a wanker. I want to be considered a real artist. So I try to be really honest with myself. And so sometimes instead of apologizing, it's better just to confess just what a rotten, son or father or nephew or dweller of a home I was, and sort of attempt to relive my life through the movies and get it right the second time around.
While a lot of your work has been about looking back, generally with regret, in this particular case, you're making the looking back tangible.
Yeah.
In a way, did you come up with rules about how you were going to reach back into time, how
yeah.
the hauntings were going to work?
Yeah, I did have a bunch of rules, but I quickly found that as I was shooting on the fly and quickly, that the rules were really, really too tough to keep up with. And so one by one, they were quickly abandoned, and so the movie seems more controlled at first. And it seems to have rules like, one ghost cannot touch another ghost if the ghost is a ghost of a ghost, and or something like that, Rules like that, and that a house can heal over if it's a ghost house within the dream of another ghost house, but otherwise it can't heal over, things like that. And then finally I went, what the hell? It's just a bunch of ghosts talking to each other anyway, and who can keep, at that point, the rules of conduct would be impossible to impose anyway, and I'll just skip the rules, and I'll just accept the fact that all of our... Since we all live, as Faulkner famously pointed out, in the past and the present simultaneously, that all of our ghosts, if you just consider our memories of people and places and things, ghosts. Because I don't really believe in, you know, skeletons with chains rattling and things like that. If you just consider these memories ghosts, they're all in a constant clamorous conversation with each other anyway. And so I thought these memories don't obey much in the way of rules, or not in etiquette anyway. So I thought I'd abandon rules. And I've never been much of a board game player or a game player. I like my baseball and football, but rules for ghosts seemed like more like the domain of a video game or a board game or something. So I just thought, I better skip it. Be more honest if I just let these things sort of run amok.
You're continuing your collaboration with George Tolles on this. It's over 20 years that you've worked with him. How have things changed over that amount
of time?
That's
an interesting question. Well, George started out as my best friend. I met him in 1980 when I was still a math and economics geek. And he taught me how to just switch hemispheres. So I rotated my hemispheres and started reading a lot of fiction, going to plays, and watching movies, most importantly. And somehow I realized that I should have been inhabiting that hemisphere all along. And so it was kind of neat that roughly halfway through my life, I just abandoned one hemisphere almost completely. I can't do my income tax now, and can't add a column of numbers for the life of me. Yeah, exactly. But so he started as my best friend, just simply, but it's kind of a mentor, you know, or a tour guide through the very intimidating for someone starting late as a reader. Didn't really read my first book until I was 24, but he took me by the hand and showed me the world of literature, at least his world of literature, and it was pretty consonant with, you know, the New York Review of Books and all the Titanic canonical greats. And so I managed to get, rather than just discovering on my own, I had at least a full year of guidance through him, through movies. So I really was able to catch up and be by the end of that year, like even a complete total snob about my taste in books and film, even though just 1 year earlier I didn't know what the hell I was doing. When I decided I wanted to start making films, he started as my script editor, and he was an excellent editor. And he never had much ambition in writing himself, but as we evolved together, he got more and more confidence as a writer, and we gave each other a lot of confidence, and we were each other's biggest fans, as is often the case with these things. It's kind of cute to think back on now. We'd allow ourselves to daydream all sorts of ridiculous things. From the isolation of Winnipeg, you can imagine Academy Awards being given to, in categories that don't even exist, you know, best Canadian-American co-production of screen treatment, and I don't know. And then it evolved over the years, I guess, as I wore so many hats on the productions, George really liked to be considered a screenwriter exclusively, and our paths diverged for a while, and we quit writing together for a while, and I became more narcissistically obsessed with my own feelings. I thought that I quickly rejected the idea that I'd ever be a sophisticated technical filmmaker, you know, that I'd never have a budget to master CGI, and I'd probably never be a great actors director. So I thought I would stay in the realm of trying to F the ineffable through really primitive surrealistic techniques and fairy tale like story structures. And George was always trying to push me towards more Chekhovian treatments of naturalistic world experiences or experiences of the human condition, and I just knew that wasn't my strength. So for a while we parted company, but then he came back and he started to understand again that I really like to. I really have sort of a more primitive collage-y, slash and paste kind of way of assembling things. involving types more than characters sometimes. And maybe that's just dating back to my love of famous monsters of filmland and Universal horror films, the allegories that those horror films are, Val Lewton, stuff like that. I still like little allegorical horror films. I have a soft spot for really cheap gore now and then, but that's just to sort of wash away any pretense that I might be too serious. You know, there's nothing like just washing with a bucket of blood away all the stale air that this blowhard can produce now and then. We finally got in sync again on this one. We'll see how it goes. I know George really likes writing alone, and I like the idea of conceiving scripts that are less and less dependent on the word, the written word. As a matter of fact, for Keyhole, I had originally envisioned the movie as having virtually no dialogue, almost none. Maybe I described it as maybe 10% the normal amount. And I even went to great pains to write the original treatment based on a series of collage parties I had, rather than all image-based ideas, rather than any written word. That eventually got abandoned when I decided to use the story structure, the ancient and durable story structure of the Odyssey, for at least a starting point. And so it returned to the word from the image, and then George came on board to help with a few words of dialogue, which ended up sort of growing like a like Virginia creeper all throughout the script. But it's been a strange and long process working with George. Each script's been a little different. Sometimes he writes the whole thing, sometimes I write the whole thing, but we've got this sort of Lennon-McCartney thing going where we just put both names on.
Did you map out the house at all, or did it not really matter?
In one version of the script, I thought I'd really have a Robert McKee-like script concerned with letting the viewer know exactly where Ulysses was at any point in his progress toward the bedroom, and letting the viewer start pulling for him, and then enjoying his setbacks in a kind of a big snakes and ladders kind of game. And probably would have been doing myself a favor with something like that. The house, it would have been nice just to get my own child at home and rent it, but that was just cost prohibitive. Besides, it isn't that labyrinthine except in my heart, that house. And so I had a designer, my old production designer, Ricardo Alms, just built a house, and I made some requests that I really wanted frames within frames within frames. And so he lined up a bunch of doorways. Sometimes you could see six doorways within each other as you look down. But I didn't map it out. He just showed me some designs, and I signed off on them immediately. And besides, for dirt cheap, he actually gave me, I've never even been able to afford stairs before, but he gave me even a second story. So I was really thrilled to get this. But when I shot it, it really didn't matter to me where. The way I shoot is almost always in close-ups without really wide establishing shots, so no one really knows where anyone is at any given time. And I don't think I'm the kind of guy who'll ever have a really strong, formal sense of space in my homes. I don't even care. I'm not one of those people that needs to know exactly how many hours have gone by inside a narrative or exactly where people are. I watch so many found footage films where people are edited into place in relation with each other, even if they were shot in two different countries decades apart. And I love the way editing works that way, and I have a supreme confidence in just the power of montage. So I don't really care about where people are. My very first film I shot with The Dead Father, a short film. The two stars, one of them was the dean of medicine at the University of Manitoba, the other one was in law school, and they were never available at the same time, but the entire movie was them together, and so I had to shoot them separately all the time and then just edit them together, and it works just fine. So I learned then, I don't even care if people are in the same shot ever or in the same room or the same country, so I don't care.
It would have been great doing McCartney and Stevie Wonder on Ebony and Ivory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you could just just shoot away without concerns.
The last time we talked was My Winnipeg, and we talked a little bit about your move to digital, and I take it has continued.
It's complete now, yeah. I like it. I know people who follow me, whoever they are, must have figured I'd be the last person to switch to digital, and that I maybe ride around on a penny farthing with a straw boater and spats or something like that. But no, I'm kind of a normal guy. Mm-hmm. You know, need a haircut. And I think I have a scalp infection right now. But other than that, you know, yeah, it's not contagious. It's just flaky. I think I was just on the airplane for too long for like three straight days. But anyway, I love the convenience of it. I had been dying to go digital for a long time, but I'd been telling myself and believing my own line of hooey that there's such a thing as a film script and then a video script. And I thought that my subjects, the ones I keep dealing with, you know, about loss and longing and melancholy and memory and things, were definitely the domain of emulsions, film emulsions. And then I started really, I'm going, you know, I'm just bullshitting myself because, you know, all those feelings have been around for a lot longer than photography, which was invented in 1827. And, you know, artists had no trouble evoking universal feelings about all those things. And so just because something's digital doesn't, you know, that's ridiculous. You know, in just a few years, it'll be a ridiculous position to take, you know. It'll be as ridiculous as how people look now 100 years ago who said that, you know, making art out of film was impossible, that it was a, you know, it'd sort of be like people who say that art on the internet's impossible now or video game art is impossible. They might be right. I don't know.
Your next frontier. Quentin Tarantino, by the way, is going to be the last guy doing film, I think. So
you figure, yeah. I've never seen. I can never picture him on a penny farthing.
It's a little too back, a little too far back, even for him.
Pam Grier on a penny farthing, I would pay money to see.
Wouldn't argue with you. The thing that I noticed here is that you do allow things like characters to drop out of focus, and it raises the question for me. I mean, one of the knocks against digital is that it makes things too easy. That's one of the big cinematographer complaints about it. And since, you know, I know you do like, in some ways, the effect of random events on an image. How do you allow the random to occur when things get not maybe too perfect, but a little closer?
It was a worry of mine. You know, I was really used to the kind of accidents that happen consistently in film, and I needed those accidents. I needed all accidents or happy accidents in film, and except for the one where the lab completely loses all your footage. But with digital, I was worried that there were fewer accidents, or the accidents were charmless or whatever. But I've since discovered that there's all sorts of, at later stages of post-production, there's all sorts of artifacting. They're definitely digital accidents, but just embrace them, you know. Embrace them, and they'll be just as beloved someday as, you know, video artifacting from VHS or TV artifacting, you know, the optical hiss on soundtracks from late night movies, or just scratchy film emulsions, or, you know, the mold and mildew that you see in Decasia and you know, the Bill Morrison kind of fetishism that I love so much as well. And so I just kind of learned to love all of this. My new production designer, Galen Johnson, was downloading some Sokurov films for me. And Sokurov has already got all sorts of really interesting interventions in his films. You know, he'll shoot things that seemingly are reflected off on an almost calm pond. For the entire movie seems to be reflecting slowly off something that's just wiggling like jello in slow motion. And he started watching a download when it was only 75% complete, and I guess the downloads were happening in random places in the movie, and so every now and then he would get something that looked like a digital download that had then been melted, like a Salvador Dali wristwatch, and but with pixels missing, and God, that looked great. And so I just realized, you know, and we're just scratching the surface of accidents and artifacts and wonderful things that can really mess with stuff, and, you know, the equivalent of a streaky Polaroid that wasn't quite developed properly, or, you know, whatever. There's just always something. And these are things that can be used. You know, one of my regrets is the manufactured accident, you know, and when I first discovered the Hipstamatic app on the iPhone, I fell in love with it, just like about everybody, you know, where everything all of a sudden looked like a 1967 fashion shoot or a 71 fashion shoot or whatever it is. I took a million pictures of my wife, and it was so much fun. But then you just look at Facebook, and like every second photo is a Hipstamatic app. And, you know, it's like been around for like 2 months only, and it was already overused, you know, so maybe 20 years from now, when the Hipstamatic app is long forgotten, it'll be revived in retro shoots. And the answer to a trivia question will be that the Hipstamatic app was actually a tribute to the to something that happened 40 years earlier or something. I don't know. But it'll be something that definitely set everything in the year 2011. I don't know.
It's too easy now.
Everybody's doing it.
Yeah.
Working with your ensemble, I mean, well, first off, I mean, you know, you talk about monsters of film land. I do work with the people over at CineFantastic. For them, one of the stamps of approval in a horror film is if Udo Kier shows up. And I mean, was that like when you got him, was it like, oh, yeah, made it?
Yeah, well, I felt like I was bringing, you know, I don't know, I just felt like I was bringing a whole busload of Hutterite studs over or something like that, let the cross-pollination begin, you know, that the gene pool had been stirred up considerably in Winnipeg at that point, and that I knew I'd be bringing with him all sorts of fans, and even though I think it's one of his most naturalistic and subdued performances, it's a real collectible for Udo fans. His voice is so beautiful. It sounds like, you know, tapping the bottom of a humidor with your finger or something like that. It was a beautiful voice. And I work with him a lot on my next project as well. So Udo and I have become dear friends, and I hope to keep working with him.
One more quick question. The artist won the Academy Award. Everybody was going, oh, how innovative, a silent film done in black and white. And I was sitting there going, you know, how did you feel about it?
Well, I'd already decided I've made my last silent film anyway, so I'd be in trouble if that was all I did, you know, because then I'd be perceived as some sort of copycat or something. But, well, I am a copycat. I decided to, years ago, make some silent films. I thought it was, you know, history pretty well agrees that it was an art form that hadn't exhausted itself yet when, in industrial haste, Hollywood abandoned it. So plenty left to say with silent film. I've finished with it for now because I don't want to, like I say, I don't want to be perceived as a guy who's only got gimmicks. So happy, by all accounts. The star of The Artist is extraordinarily likable. Still haven't seen the movie. I want to hate it. I'm scared I'll like it. Scared I'll love it. Saw a few minutes of it on the airplane, but that was with the sound turned off. So I have no idea what they were saying.
You have no worries about being mistaken for a copycat. You travel your own route.
Thank you.
Guy, thank you very much for talking with us.
A million thanks.
Keyhole opens in New York on April 6th, gets to Los Angeles, New Orleans, and Dallas the week after, and will keep rolling out to other cities in the weeks following through June. Keep an eye out for it and be amazed and mystified. The trailer and the link to the official website are over at mightymoviepodcast.com. And you can send me email at dan@mightymoviepodcast.com. And it's a busy week for us. We're doing a lot of geek stuff, and the next MMP is in that vein as well. But I think it'll hold your interest even if you don't own a set of Spock ears. We'll be talking with Morgan Spurlock about his joining forces with Stan Lee and Joss Whedon on the documentary Comic-Con Episode 4 of Fans' Hope. We could all be a little more nerdy in our lives, I think. Thanks for listening. Have fun. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC, copyright 2012, Dan Persons, all rights reserved, no unauthorized duplication permitted.